KALW.
We know that COVID continues to evolve, and sometimes by chance, some of these variants rise to the top of the charts, and that's what's happening now.
COVID-19 is on the rise in the Bay Area.
And now we have the emergence of this family of variants that look a little bit different, called FLIRT.
We'll get an update from a UCSF infectious disease specialist. Then we'll hear how abalone used to be a staple on Bay Area menus.
I've got an abalone here in my hand, and it's upside down, and you can see the foot. And this abalone is shocked, like, what are you doing?
And how scientists are protecting wild abalone after a landslide destroyed their habitat.
We found over 200 empty shells, so we know that we're seeing a lot of losses.
A story of fire, rain, and black abalone. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, we'll start with an update on COVID-19. You may be noticing more and more people around you getting sick with COVID these days. That's because it's made another resurgence in the Bay Area and across the nation. In the first 2 years of the pandemic, there were an estimated 1.2 million deaths from COVID. Then mass vaccinations slowed the spread of the disease, public health restrictions were relaxed or eliminated altogether. But the virus has continued to adapt. In San Francisco, COVID-19 positive tests, hospitalizations, and deaths are once again on the rise. The culprit this time is a variant called FLIRT, F-L-I-R-T. KALW News editor Sunni Khalid spoke to Dr. Peter Chin Hong, a professor at UCSF Health's Division of Infectious Diseases, about the resurgence and what can be done to curb it.
We have seen an upsurge in COVID recently. It's been going around the area. I know that a couple months ago you had told me that a new strain might be coming out. Can you tell us more about the FLIRT variation and what the public can do to protect themselves?
Yeah, so we know that COVID continues to evolve, and sometimes by chance, some of these variants rise to the top of the charts. And that's what's happening now. We had an older variant in the winter. A lot of people got sick. It was called JN1. And now we have the emergence of this family of variants that look a little bit different, called FLIRT. And there are three of those, KP1, KP2, and KP3. And there's another one too called LB1. But the big point is that they're different enough so that our immune system can help protect us from serious disease if you've been exposed before, you've gotten a vaccine. But it's not quite as good at preventing the virus from getting in the door. And that's why a lot of people seem to be getting ill right now. It's also the time when our antibodies wane since about 4 to 6 months since the last time you were infected. And people are gathering together for, you know, graduations, they're traveling, and the heat is bringing a lot of people indoors to escape, you know, the oppressive outdoor temperatures. That's bringing a lot of noses and mouths together. So all in all, a lot of good soil to spread a lot of virus around. And we see this in the wastewater.
What about the symptoms for each of these particular variations of the virus?
Yeah, so the symptoms are very similar to what people have remembered. So stuffy nose, congestion, headache, muscle aches, fatigue, cough. In some people, they may get more seriously ill after a few days. And of course, we know the symptoms of serious COVID, but that's a minority of folks. But they tend to be older and very immune compromised. But some people may also have strange symptoms that they don't normally associate with COVID, like nausea or diarrhea. But what we've found out over time is some of these weird symptoms can happen in the absence of a sore throat or congestion. So it's important for people to be alert to any symptoms that they might have that's not their normal around this time, even if they think it's allergies, particularly if people around them have COVID or, you know, they've heard they were infected recently.
Besides quarantine, are there any other public health measures that need to be taken?
Yeah, so I think some of the main rules about protecting yourself and your loved ones are really getting the vaccine, especially if you're older than 65 or immune compromised. More than half of Americans over 65 have not even gotten the latest shot, which was approved in the fall of 2023. So I'd say go ahead and get one now if you haven't, and you've particularly if you fall in those risk groups. Number two, of course, if you are vulnerable and you got infected, don't forget about Paxlovid or other antivirals. Number three is, you know, I always walk around with a mask in my pocket. If that person in the plane is coughing, at least you can have agency and be important. Of course, we knew about ventilation, but I think we've forgotten some of those lessons. You know, even if you're not, some of your loved ones might, and at the minimum, it's going to disrupt your plans. If you're traveling, if you're going to a wedding, if you're going to a family reunion, who wants to be sick at this point?
Doc, usually my last line is, what's coming next? It's not the monkeypox. What's next on the horizon as far as infectious diseases that we're going to have to be on the lookout for?
I think everybody's worried about avian flu H5N1 now. It's been in the news. We know a lot of dairy cattle are infected in multiple states. We know that some dairy workers and chicken farm workers have been ill with avian flu. It hasn't really mutated to make it easier to spread from human to human next yet, but that's the next worry. The government is making vaccines. We have a drug. We may have mRNA vaccines for that soon, but that will probably be the newest threat, I think, to Americans and to people around the world.
That was KALW News Editor Sunni Khalid speaking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, professor at UCSF Health's Division of Infectious Diseases. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. We're going to Monterey for our next story from our series Culture Keepers, profiles of people who maintain and create traditions in the Bay Area.
People just look at it like you're just driving a piece of junk on the streets. But to us, it's like a canvas on wheels.
There's a lot of dirt, rocks, love, and sweat. Maybe a couple of cigarettes.
Do coffee. Do something. No rights reserved, no wrongs preserved.
I felt like I was with my people.
Abalone used to be a common Bay Area dish, but the sea snail has become endangered, and now it's a delicacy. KALW's Michaela Sia takes us to meet some of the people keeping the local culinary culture of the abalone alive.
It's 10 a.m. in Monterey, and I'm heading to a farm. But this isn't the sprawling vegetable farm you might be thinking of. This is an abalone farm.
Grab these handles, step across, and just take your time. It's kind of wet and slippery.
I'm near the end of the wharf of Art Seavey, a co-owner of Monterey Abalone Company. We climb down a ladder to a narrow wooden plank. Deep underwater next to us are large cages. One of Art's employees hoists the cage up above the surface so we can see. Inside is like a parking garage with dozens of abalone stuck to each level.
I've got an abalone here in my hand, and it's upside down, and you can see the foot. And this abalone is shocked. Like, what are you doing? Why did you pull me off the panel?
He's like curling into himself.
Yeah.
Abalone are known for their beautiful iridescent shells, but inside is a blob-like animal with tiny black tentacles poking out. Their body is really just this giant foot that looks like the bottom of a snail, which they are, sea snails.
Wow, it's pretty slimy.
Yeah.
Oh, and he's kind of heavy. He's kind of heavy.
This abalone is about the size of my palm. It took years to grow to that size. Baby abalone are bred up north. They start as microscopic larvae, then start growing their shell. When they are old enough, they are put into undersea cages here, where they are pulled up once a week by farmers and fed locally harvested kelp.
If the abalone was in the water and you had a piece of seaweed and you tickled one of those tentacles with it, it would grab it.
Before Art was a farmer, he was a diver. He started abalone diving when he was a teenager, when it was more abundant.
The sort of the adrenaline of getting into the water at, you know, 7 in the morning, that adrenaline rush was kind of addictive to, you know, just kept, you know, we got to go diving and get some abalone.
After, he would cook the best of his harvest to make what's called abalone steak for his family.
I, you know, bread it lightly and saute it in butter. I try to keep it simple.
His love for diving for the sea snail is what led him to become one of the owners of the farm in 1994. Back then, there were 13 other farms, but because of disease, overfishing, and destruction of habitat, the red abalone, which is what Art raises, declined. Commercial fishing and Art's hobby of recreational diving became illegal, and what Art does, the sustainable growing of abalone, is expensive. And of those 13 farms, he's one of the only ones left.
So abalone goes back, Monterey, at least 10,000 years. So we're the native people, the Indian people of Monterey, who were the Rumson people. They were the first divers going to that bay.
That's Tim Thomas, a fisheries historian from Monterey.
So they have a word for the red abalone, which was aloon, and then linguists have traced that word abalone all the way back to that word aloon that starts right here in Monterey.
Tim says the next people to harvest the abalone were Chinese and Japanese fishermen who would send the product back to their home countries where abalone is commonly eaten. The Chinese industry met its end in the 1890s because of racist laws such as the Scott Act, which banned Chinese workers from re-entering the country. The abalone didn't become mainstream in America until the 1900s, when a German chef named Pop Ernest Dolter opened a restaurant close to the wharf in Monterey. He served a new dish he invented called abalone steak, the same one that Art used to cook.
And soon people came for all of the fresh abalone steaks at Pop's restaurant.
Pop bought his abalone from Japanese divers. Together, they made abalone a sensation. Tim says the majority of the businesses on the Monterey Wharf were
Japanese-owned, fish markets, abalone processes, all because of that recipe.
Abalone became such a cultural icon, customers even wrote songs and poems about it.
Some folks boast to quail on toast because they think it's Tony, but I'm content to owe my rent and live on abalone.
There was even an event called the Chocolate Abalone Dive, an underwater scavenger hunt for abalone-shaped chocolates covered in gold foil. To this day, there are annual abalone races in Monterey, and the shells are still sold as souvenirs.
Because of that recipe, you literally saved this industry, right?
But then, during the 1940s, the Japanese were imprisoned in internment camps during World War II. Pop's restaurants closed in the 50s. And after the 1980s, abalone was no longer abundant. Some people think they were overfished. They definitely were victims of disease and climate change. Now, the days of cheap abalone dinner are over and has become a luxury food that's really only served at fine dining restaurants.
This guy, we're going to take him off here, and then we're just going to pull it right off.
This is Chef Johnny Black, co-owner of the Michelin star restaurant Chez Noir in Carmel. He's cutting the abalone out of the shell.
So this guy will slice super thin, and then we skewer it onto the bay leaf like this. And then we go right onto the coals.
Johnny added his abalone skewers as an appetizer in 2022 to pay homage to the area. Before, he experimented with different abalone dishes, but this one really made an impression.
Sometimes guests want to have abalone and just abalone. They think that anything else detracts from the flavor of the abalone. All right, well, we're going to give them what they asked for. We're just going to give them abalone on a stick.
The skewers became the talk of the town.
That's the top dish that people like comment on. It's just like, oh, the abalone was so good. It's kind of like... Yes, thank you. Like, talk to me about another dish.
Johnny understands why people are obsessed, though.
I think it really brings people back to a different time or to something that maybe their parents made for them or something like that. So it is nostalgic in a way.
Johnny takes the two skewers off the grill and plates them on a shimmering abalone shell. taking a bite was like a taste of California history.
Oh, that was really good.
Right.
That was really, really good. Well, I want to do another bite. That was really good. I can see why it's a signature dish. Yeah,
in Monterey, I'm Michaela Sia for Cross Currents.
Michaela reported that story as a fellow in KLW's summer training program. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. As we just heard, disease and overfishing reduced populations of abalone along our coastline. But in the last few years, scientists identified a new threat: landslides. Landslides can put lives and habitats in danger, and even creatures who live underwater can feel the effects. In 2021, a Big Sur landslide covered an endangered abalone species habitat. Scientists were shocked when they saw the damage.
These guys are just hanging on for dear life in here. And this guy's got a cracked shell.
Next, we're revisiting our story about the scientists who launched a marine snail rescue mission. Reporter Anne Marshall Chalmers reports.
Jocelyn, I'm going to give you some chalk, just in case we need to mark a spot.
Five scientists are searching for prime abalone real estate along the Big Sur coast. It's work that requires a very low tide, and on this summer day in 2021, that means a 4 a.m. start time. Just headlamps and flashlights bobbing around in the dark.
We're just going to scout this way for a specific location.
Dressed in waders and boots, the scientists are here to return rescued black abalone to the wild.
Do you want to unwrap those and you'll give them to Dan?
One person lifts an abalone out of Trader Joe's tote bags where it's been waiting in cold, wet towels. Another person stands with a clipboard and records where each is placed.
We're looking at the habitat, whether there are resident abs there.
This is Wendy Bragg. She's a marine ecologist and doctoral student at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She says you can tell good abalone habitat by seeing if other abalone, or abs, live there.
We want to make sure that other abs have, like, pre-approved it, basically.
Black abalone are one of the only abalone species that live in the intertidal zone, where the land meets the ocean. And in August of 2020, the mountains above black abalone habitat were burning.
The Dolan fire burning in Big Sur has now burned 8,000 acres. No containment here. No official number of...
The Dolan fire wound up scorching nearly 200 square miles of brush and grass along the Big Sur coast. The following winter, the burn scar was hit with about 16 inches of rain, causing a debris flow of mud, rock, even a chunk of Highway 1 to slam into intertidal areas full of black abalone.
You don't think of it as like exploding out of the mouth of a river, but it really did explode. And we found evidence of that. You know, minivan-sized boulders had moved, pieces of cliff were sheared off of bedrock.
Bragg and her team were surprised to find an entire coastal ecosystem had vanished, and abalone were not spared. Once waves cleared some of the sediment,
we found over 200 empty shells. So we know that we're seeing a lot of losses.
It's still not determined exactly how many black abalone died in the debris flow of 2021, but Bragg estimates it's in the thousands. Not great news for an endangered species. With help from the multi-agency Rocky Intertidal Network, Bragg was able to rescue about 200. The animals spent a few months in tanks, and that's what brings us to today, when some are finally returning to the intertidal.
When you actually get to put them in place and they attach and they just, it's really, it's a wonderful feeling because we've rescued these from someplace where they were, you know, basically the walking dead.
Most emerge from the bags with antenna popped out, their fleshy, muscular foot that they use to attach to rocks, is swiveling clockwise and counterclockwise. One comes out especially eager.
Oh, he's just crawling on my finger, so I got him out of the bag. He's just really excited to be out and finding someplace new.
Bragg helps one of her students place an abalone on the underside of a rock. They hope the creature will latch on immediately and not resist their new habitat.
So we're going to try to get him right up there or right in here. So we're just going to hold him. Yep. And we'll see if it's, you'll see. See, there he goes. It's immediate.
That's immediate?
When do I just hold him. Okay, give him a second to kind of...
latching.
Yep. And then you can like just soften your hold just a little.
They can't help but smile like proud parents.
That was awesome.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
Black abalone used to cover much of the coast of California. But in the 80s, a disease called withering syndrome hit hard. Caused by a bacteria that infects tissues, abalone become weak and die. Populations declined by more than 90%. And in 2009, black abalone were listed as endangered. But Big Sur has remained an abalone stronghold, with 70% of the healthy population living and reproducing here.
Well, the Big Sur coast is also really steep and is known to have, you know, unstable soils, and you see landslides.
As California gets more severe fires, that means more landslides here.
All of that sediment is going to go someplace. And in Big Sur, there's a lot of this really good black abalone habitat, this rocky intertidal. And as that sediment hits the coast, it's burying abalone.
The National Marine Fisheries Service believes healthy black abalone populations like what's in Big Sur will have to stay abundant and reproducing for the species to rebound. This is where Bragg's relocation efforts could really pay off. In the aftermath of another debris flow or oil spill, Bragg's work could offer a template for how to rescue endangered snails and move them into a new home. But first, she has to make sure all those transplanted snails are doing okay. A year and a half after returning rescued abalone into the wild, Bragg and her team are back, this time during the day. But even in broad daylight, finding the creatures is an hours-long game of hide-and-seek.
Okay, under boulder two, I have an adult. Two Big adults.
Splash.
Two adults under two.
Bragg and her team look like crabs crawling over, under, and around rocks.
So we call it intertidal yoga to get to them.
At one point, she lies on her stomach and drapes her body over a rock to look underneath into a dark opening.
Nate, I might need help counting this from the other side.
Okay, where? From where?
From where my feet are.
She points a flashlight while another biologist twists himself to look from a different angle.
What I can see from this side is a foot, but I think I saw the shell from that side. So looking
I
from
see
here,
there's one right here. Flips out.
Yeah, do you see it from the other side too?
Their total count of abalone today, both residents and transplants, is similar to the total from a year and a half ago. No major losses.
So we had a really good day. We were able to survey all of our sites thoroughly, which was nice.
Bragg knows rescuing abalone takes a lot of work, and she does wonder whether grant funding that paid for this rescue project might be better spent researching how to breed black abalone in captivity. Eventually, though, any abalone bred in a lab would need to relocate to the wild, and that's where Bragg could step in.
As a biologist and somebody who just loves nature, I think every species is worth saving. I think, you know, that there are more and more challenges to species these days because of changes that are going on in the world around us. A lot of those are due to actions by humans, and so I guess I feel like we have the responsibility to do as much as we can.
As the team finishes up, a sunset explodes over the Pacific in fiery orange. Bragg holds a few empty abalone shells in her hand and takes it in. In a few days, she'll be back out doing her intertidal yoga and checking in on dozens of endangered abalone that nearly didn't make it. Along the Big Sur coast, I'm Anne Marshall Chalmers for Cross Currents. That story first aired last year. Find all our science and nature reporting at klw.org/crosscurrents. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. We'll hear about a secret event venue hiding near Jack London Square.
It's pretty cool, too, because I feel like people reach out and I get to be like, do I want a concert of this, like, in my downstairs? Like, yeah, I do. Yeah, I think I do.
Shh, it's Oakland's secret. Tomorrow morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Christopher Alam, Hussein Khan, James Rollins, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tenz, Shireen Adil, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.